Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. For generations, important aspects about slave life on the plantations of the American South have been the subject of heated debate. Some historians have insisted that slavery was cruel, others that it was more benign. And many from both sides have concluded that regardless of the conditions under which they served, slaves were generally pliant and resigned to their lives as human chattel, and that violent resistance was rare. In a moment, we will revisit those debates with historians John Hope Franklin and Lauren Sweninger. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week, in 1898, the United States battleship Maine blew up in Havana Harbor, killing more than 260 crew members. The Maine had been sent to Havana after a riot in that city in January pitted members of the Cuban independence movement against Spanish authorities and, it was said, threatened American life and property. On February 15th, while at anchor in the harbor, the ship was destroyed. The Navy Department appointed a court of inquiry, but before it could issue a ruling, leading American newspapers attributed the disaster to enemy agents and demanded U.S. intervention. "Remember the Maine" became a popular slogan. By the time the Naval Court of Inquiry reported that the Maine had been destroyed by an anti-submarine mine, popular opinion had already begun clamoring for war. President McKinley resisted at first, but then petitioned Congress for authorization to intervene in Cuba to reestablish peace. When Spain resisted, an escalation of threats and counter-threats ensued until the end of April, when Spain and the United States went to war. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, almost 30 years after his ascension to power as a rightist dictator, Chilean General Augusto Pinochet may never stand trial for the hundreds of thousands of Chilean dissenters that were tortured and murdered under his oppressive regime. These are the findings of government officials in Britain, where the former leader has been under house arrest for over a year. Madrid has been requesting the extradition of the general to Spain, where he would stand trial in the homeland of many of his victims. However, due to deteriorating health since his arrest, British officials have stated that no purpose would be served by holding a lengthy, publicized trial, and that they are inclined to simply send the Chilean president back to his native Chile. Of course, this decision has sparked great dissent among human rights groups throughout the world, arguing that illness is not a pardon for injustice. After countless efforts by the Kennedy estate to prevent exploitation of the sixth floor in the Texas School Book Depository, the location from which President Kennedy's assassin laid in wait, the window view from Lee Harvey Oswald's perch is now available on the Internet. While living relatives have approved of the sixth floor being turned into a living memorial of the 35th president, replete with museum-like atmosphere, the Kennedy family finds this new Internet attraction to be both insensitive and tasteless. Included in this sixth-floor museum are a preservation of the wooden crates stacked near the window, as well as a glass barrier that walls off the infamous corner from visitors. Many have found the museum to present an accurate representation of the events on that fateful day in 1963. Whether they will frequent the controversial computer-generated image remains to be seen. You're listening to Talking History. Nobody knows the trouble Runaway Slaves, Rebels on the Plantation by John Hope Franklin and Lauren Sweninger has been described as a sweeping panorama of plantation life before the Civil War. As a groundbreaking analysis of slave resistance and escape, and as a searing indictment of plantation life in the antebellum South. Nearly everyone agrees, however, it's one of the most important books ever written on American slavery. So we're pleased to have with us today the authors of Runaway Slaves, John Hope Franklin and Lauren Sweninger. Franklin is James B. Duke Professor of History Emeritus at Duke University. Sweninger is Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Professor Franklin, what sets this book apart from the rest to merit such attention?
Well, I would say that without being too immodest, that there have not been really any thoroughgoing examinations of slaves' reaction to their status, and particularly as it bears on the way in which the plantation was managed. So this is an examination of plantation management, as well as the slaves' reaction to their status. And the management was, from our point of view, not sufficient to handle the slaves well and to keep them on the plantation. On the other hand, the slaves show an aggressiveness and a restlessness that we haven't ordinarily discovered. And when you put these two things together, it means the slaves are going to run away. Okay. In considerable numbers.
Well, I want to pick up on that idea of conditions. Professor Swenninger, historians have not always agreed on these conditions on plantations prior to the Civil War. Some say that it was comparatively a paternal system. Others are saying it was quite brutal. Where do you and Professor Franklin come down on this?
Well, we have examined sources that were written at the time about events that occurred during the period that we look at, from 1790 to 1860. And the sources that we have looked at, runaway slave notices and legislative petitions and petitions to county courts and other contemporary information, suggest that, number one, if a slave responded, man or woman, responded to his or her bondage by leaving the plantation, they were dealt with at first with punishment that was fairly harsh, but if they continued this type in the owner's perspective of, quote, behavior, they were punished severely. And thus, if you look at slavery from a contemporary documentary evidence standpoint and look at the response of slaveholders to this turmoil in their midst, you get a different picture of the peculiar institution than if you look at it from the master's house or from the plantation big house, which some historians have done. Thus, we find that there is a constant conflict and a constant theme of violence that occurs. And we have found, for example, in the lower Mississippi River Valley, into the 1820s, there was still branding. A slave would run away, and the master would advertise he has Orleans branded on his back. We found that even early in the 19th century, slaves who committed some crime and ran away, in South Carolina, for example, a slave in 1802 was burned at the stake because of his assault on a master. So we find that paternalism really doesn't fit. It was a word that that means that slave owners treated their slaves as a father would treat children, and we find that that's, at least from the perspective of how we're looking at it, was far from accurate.
Okay, well, if paternalism doesn't work, you mentioned a response here, running away, and Professor Franklin also made reference to a response. Looking at it in a little more general terms, this is a complicated issue, too, with historians, some saying, yes, there was great resistance, and others saying, no, the slaves were resigned and pliant. Again, what did you find in your study?
Well, we found that there was a constant resistance to the system, and we looked at the response of Southern white slaveholders to this turmoil in their midst. They formed patrols, they formed militias, they formed groups to scout out slave cabins. They stood guard. There, in some parts of the South, it was like an armed camp, literally, and one traveler in Mississippi, for example, Frederick Law Olmsted, who was a famous writer who traveled throughout the South, stopped in Mississippi, and in those days you would share a room with other people, and he was sharing a room in a hotel in a small town in Mississippi, and he barricaded the door, his roommate barricaded the door to protect himself, he said, and put a pistol on a little table next to his bed. And this was all because, as Olmsted was told, runaway slaves were lurking in the distance. So we find this throughout the slave system, where slave owners are expressing fear and anxiety, and people are expressing fear and anxiety about runaways and about others that have left the plantation.
Professor Franklin, I want to talk more about runaways, which is obviously the focus of your book, but let me ask you first, what other kinds of resistance was there on the southern plantation? We don't recall many slave rebellions, for example, in the American South as we do in the Spanish South. So what kinds of resistance were there?
Well, rebellion was the most extreme and most desperate form of resistance to slavery, and given the patrollers and given the surveillance generally and given the capacity of management to handle all of the areas and avenues and instruments by which one might be able to carry on an insurrection or rebellion, it's not surprising that there were few of them. On the other hand, slaves had other ways to resist. They could malinger, that is, they could loaf on the job and affect the bottom line for the planter in a very definite way by decreasing their productivity. They could do harm to the tools. They could break a hoe or a plow or some other a rake or something they were using, and that would set the owner back. They could feign illness. I don't feel well today. Well, the owner might be skeptical, but he'd be better advised to either to let that slave rest or to get a doctor or somehow find out whether or not he is telling the truth. For if he is telling the truth and the owner insists on working him, then the owner might have a dead slave on his hands, which that means a loss of hundreds of dollars. Then there were other ways of some cooks poisoned their owners' food and in that way made it difficult for them, or they might engage in fights with their owner or their overseer. And this would show a very stiff and rather remarkable kind of resistance. So you had, up and down the line, you had various ways in which they could resist.
Right. Not very subtle, but certainly sophisticated and intelligent, it
right.
seems to me. Now, your book, Professor Franklin, focuses on runaways. So tell us what you found. How many? Who were they? Where did they go? And so on.
Well, first place, let me say that most of the runaways were not successful in the long run. There was too much against them, too many odds against them. We found that at least 50,000 a year ran away, but the number who were apprehended or the number who failed would be only a fraction of that. But they would run away again. There was no end to their running away. Some of them became habitual runaways, as they were called. Sometimes they ran away every week. Then, of course, there were men and women who ran away. We tended to have a larger number of men, but there were large numbers of women who ran away, and young and old. You might think that there would be just a youngster who would resist slavery. But we've got them 40, 50 years old resisting slavery. And we've got women running away as slaves, running away even with their small children. Sometimes a babe in arms. How far they could get with a babe in arms is open to serious question, but this is at least a reflection of the desperation that they felt if they would attempt to leave a plantation or workstation with an impediment that was so, it was as serious as a child in arms.
Given what you said earlier about the very tight controls on the plantation, though, how did they manage to escape?
Well, the controls were tight, that's in a quotation mark, for the plantation frequently relaxed their controls. If there was word of an insurrection, then they all came to attention and posted their patrols and all other measures and instruments of resistance. All there was an alert, and they did everything they could. But if the times were not tense and there was no threat they had heard about, they might relax. You know, it's something to have to stand on the road, dark road at night after midnight, and people who were drafted to do that were sometimes 20 years old and 21. They didn't like that very much. So you have to remember that many of them were lax and derelict in the performance of their duties, and this gave the slaves a chance to escape.
And where did they go?
Oh, they went in every direction. Slaves were unafraid to venture toward freedom, and they went in every direction. We usually think of them as having gone north, and that's true. Many of them went north, particularly via the Underground Railroad, etc. But they, in addition to going north, they went west. If they were in Tennessee, they might cross the Mississippi and go over into Arkansas or into the Indian Territory beyond that. If they wanted to go south, they could go down the Alabama River or some other river, and particularly if they knew or believed that their loved ones, either their husbands or their wives or their children, had been sold south, there was no reason for them to go north. They would go south looking for their loved ones. They would go from Raleigh, North Carolina to Georgetown, South Carolina. They would go from Nashville, Tennessee to New Orleans or Mobile. They would go from Louisville, Kentucky, let's say, down to into Tennessee. Or traditionally, as it's fairly widely believed, they might leave Kentucky and go to Indiana or Ohio. So that there's movement in every direction, and by people of almost every age, and by both sexes. So there's a lot of activity, and one of the things we sought to do in Runaway Slaves, our book, is to point out that the trek was not always northward.
Okay.
It was another direction.
Right. Well, we're running a little short on time. I have one question left for each of you. Professor Swenninger, you're here at Creighton as part of a program titled Let My People Go. What is that program about?
This is a documentary theater program that the Turing Theater Ensemble in North Carolina has put on. And a number of the episodes that are in this theater presentation, which is directed by Brenda Schloines, and which is, this is the 51st performance of it. We've performed at the National Archives and in Virginia and across North Carolina. A number of the episodes that we dramatize are also found in Runaway Slaves. Joseph Antoine, who was an immigrant from who had been freed in Havana, brought to the United States, fell in love with a slave woman in Virginia, was taken to Fort Vincennes. His life is portrayed in Runaway Slaves when he married a slave woman, and then they had to run away together because the master reneged. These kinds of dramatic presentations, and Joseph Antoine wrote from a courthouse. He was free, and he was literate, from a courthouse in Louisville, to tell his story. So, Let My People Go is has been a pleasure to be part of, and usually at the end of the program, I answer questions that arise, and a lot of them involve runaway slaves.
Right. It is a very good production. And finally, Professor Franklin.
It's very exciting. I've seen it and enjoyed it.
Sure. Let me ask you, Professor Franklin, I don't want to let you go, about your experience with the President's Initiative on Race. Now that your term has run out, would you kind of briefly summarize your sentiments?
Well, it was a great experience to start a dialogue among Americans about the oldest social problem in existence in this country. It was a very thrilling opportunity, and we seized it, and we undertook to initiate the dialogue, the discussion of race throughout the country. Now, one must emphasize the fact that talking in this case is important, for there had been too much silence, too much attempt to turn one's back on or to deny the existence of race as a problem in the United States. And so the first thing we did was to try to initiate a discussion all over the United States. The second thing we did was to try to get the people to understand the nature of the problem. And for that, we had experts to come in to our meetings and explain to us and explain to the general public. After all, we had the opportunity. There were reporters there. There were television and radio people there. And we wanted that spread, that is the extent to which there was a problem. We also encouraged the people in the various communities to take the initiative to do something about their problem. It might be different in Mobile, Alabama from what it is in Louisville, Kentucky. It might be different in Omaha, Nebraska from what it is in Des Moines, Iowa. But the point is to take the initiative and to seize the opportunity where people of goodwill can come together and discuss their problems and work out some solutions of them. Meanwhile, the federal government did what it could to encourage the problem by providing more support for agencies such as the Civil Rights Commission or the Committee on Equal Employment Opportunity that receive complaints, and the health agencies and the housing agencies and all of those that needed more support in order to provide better opportunities for people regardless of race. We did that and so much more. And it was a very exciting experience to find American people saying, yes, we want to engage in this. We want to do something about it. We want to discuss it. We want to act. And act they did in various ways. And we provided a book called Pathways to Progress. That is, examples of practicing promises which were started in various parts of the country, which could be replicated in other parts of the country. And so we encouraged people to do just that, and they have done it in considerable numbers. Those examples are still available, and there still is a President's Initiative on Race in the White House, even in 2000 AD. Therefore, we hope that people will continue to study it, continue to act, and continue to get information which they can get from the White House.
Oh, okay, well, thank you very much. Appreciate that, and thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to John Hope Franklin and Lawrence Wendinger, authors of Runaway Slaves, Rebels on the Plantation, published by Oxford University Press. And this is Talking History.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long way from home.
For this week's Site of the Week, we take the unusual step of recommending to you the dramatic production about which you just heard from Lawrence Wendinger, Let My People Go. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Historian Lawrence Wendinger combed through more than 18,000 county court and legislative petitions filed prior to the Civil War having to do with slavery. The personal tragedy found in those petitions is brought to the stage in the production Let My People Go, 14 stories, with some following the stereotypes, others revealing shocking, less talked about aspects of slavery, are brought to life by the talented actors. All are testament to the unspeakable acts of inhumanity that occurred during the time of slavery. The Touring Theater Ensemble of North Carolina has performed throughout the eastern part of the United States and is available for a small fee to come to your community. You can contact the Touring Theater Ensemble in Greensboro, North Carolina for more information.
Oh, let my people go. Oh, let them go. Yes, Lord, let them go.
Turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we recommend to you some very promising television programs. First on PBS on February 28th, The American Experience will air a show on one of the most controversial figures of the Civil War era, John Brown. Brown, you may recall, on the eve of the Civil War, murdered pro-slavery people in Kansas and led an attack on Harper's Ferry, Virginia, in an attempt to provoke a slave uprising before being captured and executed. Was he a martyr, a madman, a murderer, or an agitator? You decide. On February 29th, remember this is a leap year, PBS will premiere another Nova special presentation as part of its Secrets of Lost Empire series. This part of the series focuses on an iron suspension bridge built by the Chinese 2,000 years ago. And on the History Channel, at the end of February, just as the presidential race for the year 2000 is heating up, you can watch Inside the Presidency, a look at the world's most powerful office, the sometimes extraordinary efforts made by some to win that office, and how the press has covered those efforts, for better or worse, over the years. Inside the Presidency with Roger Mudd, The Press Wars, airs on February 25th. Be sure to check your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week when we take a look at the 10 worst presidents in American history. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
We carry on, coming for you, baby.